This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And it's Friday, and that means it's time for our week in review.
And what a week it was.
On Monday, the state's new congressional maps were released.
Jim McGovern's district right now, 64% of that district is new to him. Representative Neal's district out in the western part of the state, 47% of that district is new to him.
And then on Tuesday, voters around the state hit the polls to select city and town officials.
So that's the first 2 days of the week. On the third day, wait, what was it again?
And let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Oops on more than one front. We just did our own Rick Perry. The GOP presidential debate and Texas Governor Rick Perry. We will talk more about that in a moment with our panel that this week includes Julie Mohegan, deputy editorial page editor at the Boston Herald. Hi, Julie.
Hi there.
And Joan Vinocchi, columnist at the Boston Globe. Hi there, Joan.
Hello.
So let's start with Massachusetts' new 9 congressional districts. The most immediate apparent change to come out to on where those 9 districts falls includes news that Congressman William Keating and Stephen Lynch now find themselves in the same district. So, Joan, let's start with you, your reaction to the new map.
I don't think it was all that surprising. You know, the conventional wisdom all along was that Bill Keating was the last in, and he would be the first out, kind of with the musical chairs. And Steve Lynch, being the most conservative member of the delegation, I don't think there's probably a lot of love for his ideology with his colleagues. So it seemed like the natural head-to-head to set up.
And Julie, your reaction?
Well, I think it's funny. It's amazing what a previous scandal and the fear of lawsuits can do to sort of stiffen the spine. I think this is a sensible map. It looks geographically like it makes sense compared to the previous map. And I think that, a lot of credit has to go to the redistricting committee. You know, editorially at the Herald, we were in favor of an independent panel to design these maps. And we still like that idea, but these guys had a big challenge, and I think they did a pretty good job with it.
You know, if we remember that Keating actually had a close election against Republican Jeff Perry not too long ago. So, Joan, does that make you wonder how Keating will actually fare in this new district?
Well, it certainly sets up the possibility of a rematch. I haven't heard much of or from Jeff Perry since that election,
yeah.
So I have no idea what he's thinking right now. It's not as if Keating is left without any connection. He's got a summer home out on the Cape. So, you know, I don't think it's as hopeless or as scary as it could have been. I actually think that, you know, John Tierney is the weakest incumbent in the delegation right now.
And why do you say that?
Well, he's had some family-related issues that the Herald's been covering that I think a Republican would be happy to use against him.
And your thoughts on that, Julie?
I think it's, remember that Keating didn't live in the district when he was elected to that seat anyway. He's not from Quincy, so
right.
This was a relatively new district to him anyway. So I think the fact that he has to just basically establish residence at his home in Bourne, I mean, he already represents most of the Cape.
He is.
But I still don't think it's a cakewalk for him. I think that is a district where a Republican, I think I did see somewhere that Jeff Perry, who's now got a cushy job in the sheriff's office, one of the sheriff's offices, I think has said he's not going to run for that seat. So it would be interesting to see if the Republicans can field a credible candidate. And I do agree with Joan on the 6th district, especially because John Tierney picked up a couple of more conservative towns. Billerica and Tewksbury were moved into the 6th. So I think that'll be fertile ground there.
All right. So let's talk a little bit more about the big question that both of you sort of hinted at, and that is what effect this new map might have on the political makeup of the delegation overall, which is currently all Democrats. So here's Massachusetts House Republican leader Brad Jones on that issue.
I think there'll be, like there were in the past, I think there'll be one or two districts that, you know, maybe 3 districts that present an opportunity. Obviously, it remains to be seen whether we as a party take advantage of it.
Now, Joan, you mentioned that you thought John Tierney was maybe the weakest amongst the incumbent Democrats. And apparently, Richard Tesei, who most recently ran for lieutenant governor on Charlie Baker's ticket, he's a Republican, he's announced his intention to run against Tierney. So do you think that we could actually see maybe exciting races here and potentially a change in the all-Democratic makeup.
Well, I guess I agree with Brad Jones. It remains to be seen. The Republicans are always hoping and wishing and praying that they'll have a real competitive race. And for whatever the reason, they usually fizzle out. Richard Tse, sounds like a credible challenger. On the other hand, once you're out of the picture, I really don't know how strong his base of support is. And, I think Tierney's going to fight hard against the idea that he is what I just said, the weakest incumbent.
Yeah, I think there. Let's not forget that district was held by a Republican before John
right.
Tierney, and there was another McGovern seat was also held by a Republican. It's not as if it's a completely foreign concept to have a Republican member of Congress from Massachusetts, but I don't think this map is a sort of a slam dunk for the GOP in any way in any of those districts. And I think that to say we'll have the fund. I do think he'll have the ability to go out and raise a lot of money, and that'll help him in that district.
He'll also have the 2012 presidential, right?
That's right.
And the same vote or that lifts Elizabeth Warren, supposedly Barack Obama, lifts all the Democrats, I believe, at least in Massachusetts, at least.
You'll also have, though, you'll have a fair turnout for in communities that support Scott Brown that want to come out and vote and make sure that he's reelected. You'll have those people coming out as well, and I'm sure tossing votes the Republicans' way for congressional seats. So it's down to the district level, it's going to be hard to predict.
But. That's interesting. So how both presidential and senatorial politics on the national level might trickle down to the congressional races.
And there also could be a Mitt Romney turnout. Let's not forget about that.
Wait, who?
we'll get to a little bit more on that.
Teasing.
But let's sort of drill down even more locally and talk about some city elections, because on Tuesday, 53 communities across Massachusetts went to the polls. And here in Boston, the big story was regarding the re-election of City Councilor at Large Ayanna Pressley, who before election day, some people thought she might have really been on the ropes. She came on the program on Wednesday after she had won re-election, and let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say.
Anytime you try to put myself or other candidates of color in a box for who will vote for us and who our message will resonate with, you do so at your own peril.
So that's Ayanna Pressley basically talking about how you can no longer just presume that you know who's going to end up on Boston City Council based on race, because the makeup of who is the average Bostonian has changed quite a bit. Julie, let's start with you. Your reaction to Ayanna Pressley's re-election to City Council.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people saw the front page of the Herald where we called her Madam Mayor. But I also think that that's sort of a natural response to the top vote getter in the city council election is always looked at as a potential challenger to the sitting mayor. And I think also the fact that Michael Flaherty wasn't able to secure another a seat
That's
on the
right.
council also removes a potential mayoral contender there, most likely. So, we had some fun with that. But I think you're right about the changing demographics of the city. There's this sort of theme, and I haven't crunched the numbers, so I'm not sure, but there's this sort of theme of, the power center moving away from South Boston and to some of the other communities that are maybe a little bit more racially diverse.
Joan?
I agree with that. I think that Ayanna Pressley's smartest strategy was to get the word out that she was in trouble, first of all. When that happened, a lot of women rode to her side and, were determined to make sure that there was still a woman's voice on the Boston City Council. She also had help from Mayor Tom Menino, who did not want Michael Flaherty to get back on the City
mm-hmm.
Council. And she also had help from John Kerry and his grassroots organization. She had worked for Kerry previously. So I agree that this is a sign of a changing Boston and that you shouldn't characterize a black candidate and, put them in the box in terms of who would come out and support them. But there was more than one reason for that top of the ticket really surprise finish.
Well, regarding the assistance that she got from sort of Mayor Menino's ground team, which is famous for its ability to get out the vote in the city, does that sort of show us the other side of the coin, that the more things change, the more they stay the same, that we were essentially seeing the effectiveness of Mayor Menino here?
I haven't done the count. I'm sorry.
No.
I was just going to say, I think it shows that in a low, relatively low-profile election, that turnout, that old standby turnout, mm-hmm. really matters, and that if you get your voters out and if you have a mayor helping you do it and you have a sitting U.S. senator helping you do it, that it can help you top the ticket in Boston.
On the flip side, in the Dorchester district, the candidate that Mayor Menino supported and that former outgoing city councilor Maureen Feeney supported mm-hmm. Didn't win. So, you know, it really you kind of have to drill down, I think, precinct by precinct in a lot of these communities and figure out where the support came from.
Okay, well, just before we leave the issue of Ayanna Pressley, even though this is casting our minds very far into the future, since you brought it up, Julie, about the Herald cover about Madam Mayor, Joan, I just wanted to get your reaction on that.
Well, I think, you know, it was an interesting front page, and I hinted at it in my column. It wasn't as strong as the Boston Herald was. I think this does shake things up in Boston politics. Michael Flaherty, I don't know. I don't want to say it's his obituary. That sounds harsh. But he's going to have a tough – what's his platform right now? Where does he launch a mayoral campaign? This was a pretty, you know, solid rejection of him coming back and running for mayor as a Boston city councilor. So the top three vote-getters, Pressley, Arroyo, and John Connolly, if you call around the city, a lot of people think that one of them will be the next – either challenger or a strong mayoral candidate in Boston.
I was just going to say a lot of that assumes that Mayor Menino isn't going to run again in 2013 or in 2017 or in 2021, a lot of people have dubbed him the mayor for life, and I don't know if any of those councilors are going to be willing to challenge him.
Yeah. Message to Menino, though, be careful what you wish for. Michael Flaherty is not on the city council, but he may have empowered Madam Mayor.
Well, let's move on to presidential politics and the GOP debate that happened in Michigan on Wednesday night. We've got a little bit of tape here of Rick Perry at the debate, messing up quite a bit. Let's see if we can listen to that.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
So that's Rick Perry not remembering what the third one was. It was the Department of Energy. He went into immediate damage control and showed up on David Letterman to poke a little fun at himself.
Hey, listen, you try concentrating with Mitt Romney smiling at you. That is one handsome dude.
I know.
I'm not quite sure if he's dug himself out of that one yet. But, Joan, your reaction to Governor Perry?
Well, I think that was a funny line about Mitt Romney. And it was definitely a bad moment. And I hope I don't have a brain freeze now as we're talking about it. I think Perry's problem is not so much that one moment. It was bad, but it's kind of followed up a series of gaffes and poor performances on the debate trail. And it just kind of, you look at the guy and it all adds up to somebody who doesn't look or sound ready for prime time. And I think that's his big problem right now.
You know, Julie, the feeling that I got coming away from watching that is that, okay, so, and actually this was also written up in the New York Times, that it's not so much that, you know, maybe he didn't come up with his own plan, but that he didn't even know it. He couldn't even bother to memorize the three offices of government that he would want to shut down if he were president. So there's this question of how much is he actually committed to the fundamentals of what he's running on as a presidential candidate.
I understand that point of view. I've also sat in front of a microphone and had a total brain freeze.
No.
So
I thought it was interesting that New York Times article that you referenced said that he had an authenticity problem,
right,
which is what people usually say about Romney. So this is Romney's moment. He's the nominee.
I agree with that. I think I don't think actually it is necessarily an authenticity problem. I think that the authentic Rick Perry, though, has some problems with a cohesive message. And, you know, especially with moments like that, whether or not he just had a moment where his brain froze or whether he has a full grasp of his platform, perception is reality in a lot of these situations.
I agree with you. I think, you know, it also points to the fact that, you know, experience, experience, experience. Romney has run for president before. He's been through these debates before. That brings a certain, sort of ease and, you know, knowing how to deal with these situations. And Perry, you know, he out of the box in August, he's really a first-time presidential candidate, and I think that's really showing right now.
But he's won the governorship in Texas several times, though. I mean,
including in a tough race against Kay Bailey Hutchison the last time around.
But I think anybody would say that a debate at that level, where everybody is watching, when you're talking about issues at a level that you don't necessarily have to understand or talk about when you're running for governor of any state, even a big one like Texas, I just think it's a different animal.
Do you both really feel that after this sort of series of gaffes from Texas Governor Rick Perry, that sort of makes Mitt Romney the de facto nominee even before we've had our first primary?
Oh, I do. I definitely do. New Hampshire's only 8 weeks away. And, you know, I don't see Rick Perry necessarily rebuilding a credibility on a lot of issues or on his competence, at least in the optics of it all before then.
Right. Every time a new national poll comes out that shows Kane or now Gingrich supposedly surging, those are really irrelevant. Romney is ahead by 30 points in New Hampshire. If he's anywhere close to that, I don't know how you stop them.
I guess I'm wondering what impact in places like Iowa and South Carolina might have.
Well, we don't know what's going to happen in Iowa, and I suppose, you know, that will have an impact. I find it hard to believe that Perry's going to win Iowa and be the one to come in and stop Romney. Now the spotlight's on Gingrich. He's the flavor of the week.
Well, all of this assumes that Herman Cain has just completely gone by the wayside, which he had a tough week, obviously, a very tough week. But I think that he still has deep pockets of support, Tea Party support in particular, in a lot of places. In some place like South Carolina, you know, he could do quite well.
Right. And voters' contempt for the media and how they made the sexual harassment issue such a big issue for Cain can help him probably.
Well, I want to switch gears quite dramatically here before we run out of time and talk about the scandal that continues to rock Penn State, and that, of course, are the grand jury findings that sort of rampant sexual abuse was going on with, I believe he was the assistant football coach there at Penn State, and that's taken down the president of the college and also their head coach as well. Now, to a lot of people around here in Boston, including attorney Jeff Newman, who's represented 400 victims of people who were sexually abused by priests, the whole idea that an institution can protect people who have been accused of sexually abusing children, it sounds kind of like a familiar story. So here's Jeff Newman on WBUR yesterday.
It was what the university said last night when they made the decision. They said nothing of the 10-year-old boy or the five others who were molested. They said nothing about sexual abuse generally, the fact that it won't be tolerated, never tolerated. I was nearly despondent when I saw all this because I said, well, what good did all these cases do?
So just to be clear, because I was a little muddled before, it's former Penn State assistant coach Jerry Sandusky who's been arrested with charges of sexually abusing children. And, of course, Penn State's head coach Joe Paterno had been fired this week as well. So, Joan and Julie, do you see similarities here in the two cases?
I do. I mean, obviously, I don't think Penn State has, at least it doesn't appear that they have as widespread a problem as the Archdiocese had here over a period of decades. But at the same time, the idea of protecting the institution ahead of protecting the individual is, you know, pretty much exactly the same, I think. The idea of avoiding scandal. And I think that nobody really in these very powerful positions thought of the children in this situation. And I think there are similarities in that way.
It really was the first thing that I thought of when this story broke. It does feel and sound like a microcosm of the whole Catholic Church scandal, particularly if you've watched it from Boston. I think it's interesting also that Paterno and Cardinal Law are of the same generation. Paterno's 84, Law's 80. I'm not saying it giving them a pass for any reason, but there seemed to be some sort of ability to compartmentalize and say, well, we're doing all these other great things or good things, or we care about poor people, we care about kids in other contexts, and somehow not understand that you had to face this and do something about it, that crimes were being committed.
But then again, you had a 27-year-old graduate assistant who witnessed and one who witnessed this in person and called his father and then called the coach the next day. You know, I don't like to try to make judgments about other people's responses in those situations, but I think a lot of people today are thinking,
why didn't you call the police?
Yeah,
Well, there's obviously much more to discuss about that as that story continues to unfold. But we're running a little short on time, so why don't we turn to our hubbubs. And Anthony, your hubbub.
Okay. This is a little bit of breaking news. It hasn't run above the fold yet. According to Jim Salisbury of CSNPhilly.com, so there's only one source reporting this. Jonathan Papelbon, the greatest Red Sox closer ever, has signed a deal with the Philadelphia Phillies. This is a huge, wow, huge deal for Red Sox Nation. Papelbon, really one of the greatest closer ever, saved 219 games over seven seasons. He did a lot for that last World Series victory. And the last time the Red Sox appeared in a postseason game, Papelbon was on the mound. So a big loss for the Red Sox if this is, in fact, true, which it probably is.
Julie's got a look of shock on her
face. I was
going
to say, I have to recover from my deep depression
it's
my
quite stunning.
That's a huge story, yeah.
Wow.
At least in the sports world. I just wanted to mention that, you know, today is Veterans Day. We had a story in the Herald today that people can go check out about the New England Shelter for Homeless Veterans, which does really important work on behalf of folks who have served and have fallen on hard times. They're involved in this online contest to try to win. I know it's a little bit of an appeal here, but it's for an excellent cause. It's a Facebook effort to win a contest of nonprofits who are seeking funds for upgrades to their facilities. So I'm sure if you check out the New England Shelter for Homeless Veterans or our website, you can get some information on there. But I know a lot of people around here are very supportive of their efforts and would love to see them come out on top. It's hard to pick among multiple nonprofits who's the best cause, but they do great work over there.
Definitely worth checking out.
Definitely.
Joan, your hubbub?
Well, I'm going to say something relatively nice about Mitt Romney, which I don't often do. Everyone knows about the Rick Perry brain freeze. It's been less noted that the one candidate who kind of stepped in to throw him a bit of a lifeline was Romney when he said, helpfully, EPA. And it's actually the second time in a debate that Romney has either been a gentleman, tried to look likable, or has decided that Perry isn't enough of a threat to squash. But I do think it was, you know, maybe he just saw the agonizing seconds tick by and decided to do the right thing, help the guy out.
Using the moment maybe to also look presidential as well. I mean, who knows what was going through his mind.
I'm trying to be nice here.
He might have been like the rest of us who just can't stand to see someone struggle in that way. It makes you cringe, right?
Right, but everybody else stood by and was happy to have it happen.
All right, so my hubbub just very briefly has to do with the closing of Harvard Yard to non-Harvard affiliated people who don't have a Harvard ID, because apparently a little earlier this week there were some 400 students who were part of the Occupy Harvard Yard movement or wanted to. So Harvard authorities have decided that now they've closed the gates and you actually have to have a Harvard University ID to enter Harvard Yard, which for as long as I've lived here, I don't think has ever happened. It's always been a place that the public could go in and out of. So
yeah,
it seems,
for like the last half millennium.
Exactly.
I think.
So Occupy Harvard Yard, getting the Harvard gates closed. We'll see how long that lasts. Well, Joan Vinocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
And Julie Mahigan, deputy editorial page editor at the Boston Herald, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.